such as he might have worn walking forward to be knighted by the king. Tanis rose to his feet. Sturm came to him first and threw his arms around his friend. Tanis gripped him tightly, feeling the knight's strong, sinewy arms clasp him in affection. Then the two stood back to look at each other for a brief moment. "Sturm hasn't changed," Tanis thought, "except that there are more lines around the sad eyes, more gray in the brown hair. The cloak is a little more frayed. There are a few more dents in the ancient armor, but the knight's flowing moustaches, his pride and joy, were as long and sweeping as ever. His shield was polished just as brightly. His brown eyes were just as warm when he saw his friends. And you have a beard," Sturm said with amusement. Then the knight turned to greet Caramon and Flint. Tasselhoff dashed after more ale, Tika having been called away to serve others in the growing crowd.
"Greetings, knight,"
whispered Raistlin from the corner. Sturm's face grew solemn as he turned to greet the other twin. "Raistlin," he said. The mage drew back his hood, letting the light fall on his face. Sturm was too well-bred to let his astonishment show beyond a slight exclamation, but his eyes widened. Tanis realized the young mage was getting a cynical pleasure out of seeing his friend's discomfiture.
"Can I get you something, Raistlin?" Tanis asked.
"No, thank you,"
the mage answered, moving into the shadows once again.
"He eats practically nothing,"
Caramon said in a worried tone.
"I think he lives on air."
"Some plants live on air," Tasselhoff stated, returning with Sturm's ale. "I've seen them. They hover up off the ground. Their roots suck food and water out of the atmosphere."
"Really?"
Caramon's eyes were wide.
"I don't know who's the greater idiot," said Flint in disgust. "Well, we're all here. What news?"
"All?"
Sturm looked at Tanis questioningly.
"Kitiara?"
"Not coming," Tanis replied steadily. "We were hoping perhaps you could tell us something."
"Not I,"
the knight frowned. "We traveled north together and parted soon after crossing the Sea Narrows into Old Salamnia. She was going to look up relatives of her father, she said. That was the last I saw of her."
"Well, I suppose that's that,"
Tanis sighed. "What of your relatives, Sturm? Did you find your father?" Sturm began to talk, but Tanis only half listened to Sturm's tale of his travels in his ancestral land of Salamnia. Tanis's thoughts were on Kitiara. Of all his friends, she had been the one he most longed to see. After 5 years of trying to get her dark eyes and crooked smile out of his mind, he discovered that his longing for her grew daily. Wild, impetuous, hot-tempered, the swordswoman was everything Tanis was not. She was also human. And love between human and elf always ended in tragedy, yet Tanis could no more get Kitiara out of his heart than he could get his human half out of his blood. Wrenching his mind free of memories, he began listening to Sturm.
"I heard rumors. Some say my father is dead. Some say he is alive."
His face darkened.
"But no one knows where he is."
"Your inheritance?"
Caramon asked. Sturm smiled, a melancholy smile that softened the lines in his proud face.
"I wear it," he replied simply. "My armor and my weapon."
Tanis looked down to see that the knight wore a splendid, if old-fashioned, two-handed sword. Caramon stood up to peer over the table.
"That's a beauty," he said.
"They don't make them like that these days.
My sword broke in a fight with an ogre. Theros Ironfeld put a new blade on it today, but it cost me dearly."
"So you're a knight now?"
Sturm's smile vanished. Ignoring the question, he caressed the hilt of his sword lovingly.
According to the legend, this sword will break only if I do, he said. It was all that was left of my father's...
Suddenly, Tass, who hadn't been listening, interrupted.
Who are those people?
The Kender asked in a shrill whisper. Tanis looked up as the two barbarians walked past their table, heading for empty chairs that sat in the shadows of a corner near the fire pit. The man was the tallest man Tanis had ever seen. Caramon, at 6 feet, would come only to this man's shoulder. But Caramon's chest was probably twice as big around, his arms 3 times as big. Although the man was bundled with the furs barbarian tribesmen live in, it was obvious that he was thin for his great height. His face, though dark-skinned, had the pale cast of one who has been ill or suffered greatly. His companion, the woman Sturm had bowed to, was so muffled in a fur-trimmed cape and hood that it was difficult to tell much about her. Neither she nor her tall escort glanced at Sturm as they passed. The woman carried a plain staff trimmed with feathers in barbaric fashion. The man carried a well-worn knapsack. They sat down in the chairs, huddled in their cloaks, and talked together in low voices.
I found them wandering around on the road outside of town, Sturm said. The woman appeared near exhaustion, the man just as bad. I brought them here, told them they could get food and rest for the night. They are proud people and would have refused my help, I think, but they were lost and tired and... Sturm lowered his voice. There are things on the road these days that it is better not to face in the dark.
We met some of them, asking about a staff, Tanis said grimly. He described their encounter with Fewmaster Turda. Although Sturm smiled at the description of the battle, he shook his head.
A Seeker guard questioned me about a staff outside, he said. Blue crystal, wasn't it?
Caramon nodded and put his hand on his brother's thin arm.
One of the slimy guards stopped us, the warrior said. They were going to impound raced staff, if you'll believe that, for further investigation, they said. I rattled my sword at them, and they thought better of the notion.
Raistlin moved his arm from his brother's touch, a scornful smile on his lips.
What would have happened if they had taken your staff? Tanis asked Raistlin.
The mage looked at him from the shadows of his hood, his golden eyes gleaming.
They would have died horribly, the mage whispered, and not by my brother's sword.
The half-elf felt chilled. The mage's softly spoken words were more frightening than his brother's bravado.
I wonder what is so important about a blue crystal staff that goblins would kill to get it, Tanis mused.
There are rumors of worse to come, Sturm said quietly. His friends moved closer to hear him. Armies are gathering in the north, armies of strange creatures, not human. There is talk of war.
But what?
Who? Tanis asked. I have heard the same.
And so have I, Caramon added. In fact, I heard...
As the conversation continued, Tasselhoff yawned and turned away, easily bored. The Kender looked around the inn for some new amusement. His eyes went to the old man, still spinning tales for the child by the fire. The old man had a larger audience now. The two barbarians were listening, Tass noted. Then his jaw dropped. The woman had thrown her hood back, and the firelight shone on her face and hair. The Kender stared in admiration. The woman's face was like the face of a marble statue, classic, pure, cold. But it was her hair that captured the Kender's attention. Tass had never before seen such hair, especially on the plainsmen, who were usually dark-haired and dark-skinned. No jeweler spinning molten strands of silver and gold could have created the effect of this woman's silver-gold hair shining in the firelight. One other person listened to the old man.
This was a man dressed in the rich brown and golden robes of a seeker. He sat at a small round table, drinking mulled wine. Several mugs stood empty before him, and even as the Kender watched, he called sourly for another.
"That's Hedrick,"
Tycho whispered as she passed the companion's table.
"The High Theocrat."
The man called out again, glaring at Tycho. She bustled quickly over to help him. He snarled at her, mentioning poor service. She seemed to start to answer sharply, then bit her lip and kept silent. The old man came to an end of his tale. The boy sighed.
"Are all your stories of the ancient gods true, old one?"
he asked curiously. Tasselhoff saw Hedrick frown. The Kender hoped he wouldn't bother the old man. Tass touched Tanis's arm to catch his attention, nodding his head toward the seeker with a look that meant there might be trouble. The friends turned. All were immediately overwhelmed by the beauty of the plainswoman. They stared in silence. The old man's voice carried clearly over the drone of the other conversation in the common room.
"Indeed, my stories are true, child."
The old man looked directly at the woman and her tall escort.
"Ask these two. They carry such stories in their hearts."
"Do you?"
The boy turned to the woman eagerly.
"Can you tell me a story?"
The woman shrank back into the shadows, her face filled with alarm as she noticed Tanis and his friends staring at her. The man drew near her protectively, his hand reaching for his weapon. He glowered at the group, especially the heavily armed warrior, Caramon.
"Nervous bastard,"
Caramon commented, his hand straying to his own sword.
"I can understand why," Sturm said, "guarding such a treasure."
"He is her bodyguard, by the way. I gathered from their conversation that she's some kind of royal person in their tribe, though I imagine from the looks they exchanged that their relationship goes a bit deeper than that." The woman raised her hand in a gesture of protest.
"I'm sorry."
The friends had to strain to hear her low voice.
"I'm not a teller of tales. I have not the art."
She spoke the common tongue, her accent thick. The child's eager face filled with disappointment. The old man patted him on the back, then looked directly into the woman's eyes.
"You may not be a teller of tales," he said pleasantly, "but you are a singer of songs, aren't you, chieftain's daughter? Sing the child your song, Gold Moon. You know the one."
From out of nowhere, apparently, a lute appeared in the old man's hands. He gave it to the woman, who stared at him in fear and astonishment.
"How do you know me, sir?" she asked.
"That is not important."
The old man smiled gently.
"Sing for us, chieftain's daughter."
The woman took the lute with hands that trembled visibly. Her companion seemed to make a whispered protest, but she did not hear him. Her eyes were held fast by the glittering black eyes of the old man. Slowly, as if in a trance, she began to strum the lute. As the melancholy chords drifted through the common room, conversations ceased. Soon, everyone was watching her, but she did not notice. Gold Moon sang for the old man, alone.
"The grasslands are endless, and summer sings on, and Gold Moon, the princess, loves a poor man's son. Her father, the chieftain, makes long roads between them. The grasslands are endless, and summer sings on. The grasslands are waving, the sky's rim is grey. The chieftain sends river wind east and away to search for strong magic at the lip of the morning. The grasslands are waving, the sky's rim is grey. O river wind, where have you gone? O river wind, autumn comes on. I sit by the river and look to the sunrise, but the sun rises over the mountains alone. The grasslands are fading, the summer wind dies. He comes back, the darkness of stones in his eyes. He carries a blue staff as bright as a glacier. The grasslands are fading, the summer wind dies. The grasslands are fragile, as yellow as flame. The chieftain makes mockery of river wind's claim. He orders the people to stone the young warrior. The grasslands are fragile, as yellow as flame. The grassland has faded, and autumn is here. The girl joins her lover. The stones whistle near. The star flares in blue light, and both of them vanish. The grasslands are faded, and autumn is here.
There was heavy silence in the room as her hand struck the final chord. Taking a deep breath, she handed the lute back to the old man and withdrew into the shadows once more.
"Thank you, my dear," the old man said, smiling.
"Now can I have a story?"
the little boy asked wistfully.
"Of course,"
the old man answered and settled back in his chair.
"Once upon a time, the great god Paladin—"
"Paladin," the child interrupted. "I've never heard of a god named Paladin."
A snorting sound came from the high theocrat, sitting at the nearby table. Tanis looked at Hedrick, whose face was flushed and scowling. The old man appeared not to notice.
"Paladin is one of the ancient gods, child. No one has worshipped him for a long time."
"Why did he leave?"
the little boy asked.
"He did not leave us,"
the old man answered, and his smile grew sad.
"Men left him after the dark days of the cataclysm. They blamed the destruction of the world on the gods instead of on themselves, as they should have done. Have you ever heard the Canticle of the Dragon?"
"Oh, yes," the boy said eagerly. "I love stories about dragons, though Papa says dragons never existed. I believe in them, though. I hope to see one someday."
The old man's face seemed to age and grow sorrowful. He stroked the young boy's hair.
"Be careful what you wish, my child,"
he said softly. Then he fell silent.
"The story?"
the boy prompted.
"Oh, yes. Well, once upon a time, Paladin heard the prayer of a very great knight, Huma."
"Huma from the Canticle?"
"Yes, that's the one. Huma became lost in the forest. He wandered and wandered until he despaired because he thought he would never see his homeland again. He prayed to Paladin for help, and there suddenly appeared before him a white stag."
"Did Huma shoot it?"
the boy asked.
"He started to, but his heart failed him. He could not shoot an animal so magnificent. The stag bounded away, then it stopped and looked back at him as if waiting. Huma began to follow it. Day and night he followed the stag until it led him to his homeland. He offered thanks to the god Paladin."
"Blasphemy!"
snarled a voice loudly. A chair crashed back. Tanis put down his mug of ale, looking up. Everyone at the table stopped drinking to watch the drunken theocrat.
"Blasphemer!"
Hedrick, weaving unsteadily on his feet, pointed at the old man.
"Heretic! Corrupting our youth! I'll bring you before the council, old man."
The seeker fell back a step, then staggered forward again. He looked around the room with a pompous air.
"Call the guards!"
He made a grandiose gesture.
"Have them arrest this man and this woman for singing lewd songs. Obviously a witch. I'll confiscate this staff."
The seeker lurched across the floor to the barbarian woman, who was staring at him in disgust. He reached clumsily for her staff.
"No."
The woman called Gold Moon spoke coolly.
"That is mine. You cannot take it."
"Witch!" the seeker sneered. "I am High Theocrat. I take what I want."
He started to make another grab for the staff. The woman's tall companion rose to his feet.
The chieftain's daughter says you will not take it,
the man said harshly. He shoved the seeker backward. The tall man's push was not rough, but it knocked the drunken theocrat completely off balance. His arms flailing wildly, he tried to catch himself. He lurched forward, too far, tripped over his official robes, and fell head first into the roaring fire. There was a whoosh and a flare of light, then a sickening smell of burning flesh. The theocrat's scream tore through the stunned silence as the crazed man leaped to his feet and started whirring around in a frenzy. He had become a living torch. Tanis and the others sat, unable to move, paralyzed with the shock of the incident. Only Tasselhoff had wits enough to run forward, anxious to try and help the man. But the theocrat was screaming and waving his arms, fanning the flames that were consuming his clothes and his body. There seemed no way that the little Kender could help him. Here. The old man grabbed the barbarian's feather-decorated staff and handed it to the Kender.
Knock him down, then we can smother the fire.
Tasselhoff took the staff. He swung it, using all his strength, and hit the theocrat squarely in the chest. The man fell to the ground. There was a gasp from the crowd. Tasselhoff himself stood, open-mouthed, the staff clutched in his hand, staring down at the amazing sight at his feet. The flames had died instantly. The man's robes were whole, undamaged. His skin was pink and healthy. He sat up, a look of fear and awe on his face. He stared down at his hands and his robes. There was not a mark on his skin. There was not the smallest cinder smoking on his robes.
It healed him,
the old man proclaimed loudly.
The staff! Look at the staff!
Tasselhoff's eyes went to the staff in his hands. It was made of blue crystal and was glowing with a bright blue light. The old man began shouting,
Call the guards! Arrest the Kender! Arrest the barbarians! Arrest their friends! I saw them come in with this knight!
He pointed at Sturm.
What?
Tanis leaped up. Are you crazy, old man?
Call the guards!
The word spread. Did you see? The blue crystal staff! We found it! Now they'll leave us alone! Call the guards! The theocrat staggered to his feet, his face pale, blotched with red. The barbarian woman and her companion stood up, fear and alarm in their faces.
Foul witch!
Hedrick's voice shook with rage.
You have cured me with evil. Even as I burn to purify my flesh, you will burn to purify your soul.
With that, the seeker reached out, and before anyone could stop him, he plunged his hand back into the flames. He gagged with the pain, but did not cry out. Then, clutching his charred and blackened hand, he turned and staggered off through the murmuring crowd, a wild look of satisfaction on his pain-twisted face.
You've got to get out of here.
Tika came running over to Tanis, her breath coming in gasps.
The whole town's been hunting for that staff. Those hooded men told the theocrat they'd destroy Solace if they caught someone harboring the staff. The townspeople will turn you over to the guards.
But it's not our staff, Tanis protested. He glared at the old man and saw him settle back into his chair, a pleased smile on his face. The old man grinned at Tanis and winked.
Do you think they'll believe you?
Tika wrung her hands.
Look!
Tanis looked around. People were glaring at them balefully. Some took a firm grip on their mugs, others eased their hands onto the hilts of their swords. Shouts from down below drew his eyes back to his friends.
The guards are coming! Exclaimed Tika.
Tanis rose. We'll have to go out through the kitchen.
Yes,
she nodded.
They won't look back there yet. But hurry! It won't take them long to surround the place.
Years of being apart had not affected the companions' ability to react as a team to threat of danger. Caramon had pulled on his shining helm, drawn his sword, shouldered his pack, and was helping his brother to his feet. Raistlin, his staff in his hand, was moving around the table. Flint had hold of his battle-axe and was frowning darkly at the onlookers, who seemed hesitant about rushing to attack such well-armed men. Only Sturm sat, calmly drinking his ale.
"Sturm," Tanis said urgently, "come on. We've got to get out of here."
"Run?" The knight appeared astonished.
"From this rabble?"
"Yes."
Tanis paused. The knight's code of honor forbade running from danger. He had to convince him.
"That man is a religious fanatic, Sturm. He'll probably burn us at the stake, and..."
A sudden thought rescued him. "There is a lady to protect."
"The lady,
of course." Sturm stood up at once and walked over to the woman.
"Madam,
your servant." He bowed. The courtly knight would not be hurried. "It seems we are all in this together. Your staff has placed us in considerable danger, you most of all. We are familiar with the area around here. We grew up here. You, I know, are strangers. We would be honored to accompany you and your gallant friend and guard your lives."
"Come on,"
Tika urged, tugging on Tanis's arm. Caramon and Raistlin were already at the kitchen door.
"Get the kenda,"
Tanis told her. Tasselhoff stood, rooted to the floor, staring at the staff. It was rapidly fading back to its nondescript brown color. Tika grabbed Tass by his topknot and pulled him toward the kitchen. The kender shrieked, dropping the staff. Goldmoon swiftly picked it up, clutching it close to her. Although frightened, her eyes were clear and steady as she looked at Sturm and Tanis. She was apparently thinking rapidly. Her companion said a harsh word in their language. She shook her head. He frowned and made a slashing motion with his hand. She snapped a quick reply and he fell silent, his face dark.
"We will go with you,"
Goldmoon said to Sturm in the common tongue.
"Thank you for the offer."
"This way."
Tanis herded them out through the swinging kitchen doors, following Tika and Tass. He glanced behind him and saw some of the crowd move forward, but in no great hurry. The cook stared at them as they ran through the kitchen. Caramon and Raistlin were already at the exit, which was nothing more than a hole cut in the floor. A rope hung from a sturdy limb above the hole and dropped 40 feet to the ground.
"Ah!" exclaimed Tass, laughing. "Here the ale comes up and the garbage goes down."
He swung out onto the rope and shinnied down easily.
"I'm sorry about this," Tika apologized to Gold Moon, "but it is the only way out of here."
"I can climb down a rope."
Then the woman smiled and added,
"Though I admit it has been many years."
She handed her staff to her companion and grasped the stout rope. She began to descend, moving skillfully hand over hand. When she reached the bottom, her companion tossed the staff down, swung on the rope, and dropped through the hole.
"How are you going to get down, Raist?"
Caramon asked, his face lined with concern.
"I can carry you on my back."
Raistlin's eyes flashed with an anger that startled Tanis.
"I can get down myself,"
the mage hissed. Before anyone could stop him, he stepped to the edge of the hole and leaped out into the air. Everyone gasped and peered down, expecting to see Raistlin splattered all over the ground. Instead, they saw the young mage gently floating down, his robes fluttering around him. The crystal on his staff glowed brightly.
"He shivers my skin,"
Flint growled to Tanis. "Hurry." Tanis shoved the dwarf forward. Flint grabbed hold of the rope. Caramon followed, the big man's weight causing the limb the rope was tied around to creak.
"I will go last," Sturm said, his sword drawn.
"Very well."
Tanis knew it was useless to argue. He slung the longbow and quiver of arrows over his shoulder, grabbed the rope, and started down. Suddenly, his hands slipped. He slid down the rope, unable to stop it tearing the skin off his palms. He landed on the ground and looked, wincing, at his hands. His palms were raw and bleeding. But there was no time to think about them. Glancing up, he watched as Sturm descended. Tika's face appeared in the opening.
"Go to my house,"
she mouthed, pointing through the trees. Then she was gone.
"I know the way,"
Tasselhoff said, his eyes glowing with excitement.
"Follow me."
They hurried off after the Kender, hearing the sounds of the guards climbing the stairway into the inn. Tanis, unused to walking on the ground in Solace, was soon lost. Above him he could see the bridge walks, the street lamps gleaming among the tree leaves. He was completely disoriented, but Tass kept pushing forward confidently, weaving in and out among the huge trunks of the Valenwood trees. The sounds of the commotion at the inn faded. "We'll hide at Tika's for the night," Tanis whispered to Sturm as they plunged through the underbrush. "Just in case someone recognized us and decides to search our homes. Everyone will have forgotten about this by morning. We'll take the plainsmen to my house and let them rest a few days. Then we can send the barbarians on to Haven, where the Council of High Seekers can talk with them. I think I might even go along. I'm curious about this staff."
Sturm nodded. Then he looked at Tanis and smiled his rare, melancholy smile.
"Welcome home," the knight said.
"Same to you."
The half-elf grinned. They both came to a sudden halt, bumping into Caramon in the dark.
"We're here,
I think," Caramon said. In the light of the street lamps that hung in the tree limbs, they could see Tasselhoff climbing tree branches, like a gully dwarf. The rest followed more slowly, Caramon assisting his brother. Tanis, gritting his teeth from the pain in his hands, climbed up slowly through the rapidly thinning autumn foliage. Tass pulled himself up over the porch railing with the skill of a burglar. The Kender slipped over to the door and peered up and down the bridge walk, seeing no one on it. He motioned to the others. Then he studied the lock and smiled to himself in satisfaction. The Kender slid something out of one of his pouches. Within seconds, the door of Tika's house swung open.
"Come in,"
he said, playing host. They crowded inside the little house, the tall barbarian being forced to duck his head to avoid hitting the ceiling. Tass pulled the curtains shut. Sturm found a chair for the lady, and the tall barbarian went to stand behind her. Raistlin stirred up the fire.
"Keep watch," Tanis said.
Caramon nodded. The warrior had already posted himself at a window, staring out into the darkness. The light from a street lamp gleamed through the curtains into the room, casting dark shadows on the walls. For long moments, no one spoke, each staring at the others. Tanis sat down. His eyes turned to the woman.
"The blue crystal staff," he said quietly. "It healed that man."
"How?"
"I do not know," she faltered. "I haven't had it very long."
Tanis looked down at his hands. They were bleeding from where the rope had peeled off his skin. He held them out to her. Slowly, her face pale, the woman touched him with the staff. It began to glow blue. Tanis felt a slight shock tingle through his body. Even as he watched, the blood on his palms vanished, the skin became smooth and unscarred, the pain eased, and soon left him completely.
"True healing," he said in awe.
Chapter 4. The Open Door, Flight into Darkness.
Raistlin sat down on the hearth, rubbing his thin hands in the warmth of the small fire. His golden eyes seemed brighter than the flames as he stared intently at the blue crystal staff, resting across the woman's lap.
"What do you think?" asked Tanis.
"If she's a charlatan, she's a good one,"
Raistlin commented thoughtfully.
"Worm, you dare to call the chieftain's daughter charlatan?"
The tall barbarian stepped toward Raistlin, his dark brows contracted in a vicious scowl. Caramon made a low, rumbling sound in his throat and moved from the window to stand behind his brother.
"Riverwind."
The woman laid her hand on the man's arm as he drew near her chair.
"Please. He meant no harm. It is right that they do not trust us. They do not know us."
"And we do not know them,"
the man growled.
"If I might examine it,"
Raistlin said. Gold Moon nodded and held out the staff. The mage stretched out his long, bony arm, his thin hands grasping for it eagerly. As Raistlin touched the staff, however, there was a bright flash of blue light and a crackling sound. The mage jerked his hand back, crying out in pain and shock. Caramon jumped forward, but his brother stopped him.
"No, Caramon,"
Raistlin whispered hoarsely, wringing his injured hand.
"The lady had nothing to do with that."
The woman, indeed, was staring at the staff in amazement.
"What is it, then?"
Tanis asked in exasperation. "A staff that heals and injures at the same time?"
"It merely knows its own."
Raistlin licked his lips, his eyes glittering.
"Watch."
"Caramon, take the staff."
"Not me." The warrior drew back as if from a snake. "Take the staff,"
Raistlin demanded. Reluctantly, Caramon stretched out a trembling hand. His arm twitched as his fingers came closer and closer. Closing his eyes and gritting his teeth in anticipation of pain, he touched the staff. Nothing happened. Caramon opened his eyes wide, startled. He gripped the staff, lifted it in his huge hand, and grinned.
"See there?"
Raistlin gestured like an illusionist showing off a trick to the crowd.
"Only those of simple goodness, pure in heart."
His sarcasm was biting.
"May touch the staff. It is truly a sacred staff of healing, blessed by some god. It is not magic. No magic objects that I have ever heard about have healing powers."
"Hush!"
ordered Tasselhoff, who had taken Caramon's place by the window.
"The Theocrat's guards!"
he warned softly. No one spoke. Now they could all hear goblin footsteps flapping on the bridge walks that ran among the branches of the Valenwood trees.
"They're conducting a house-to-house search,"
Tanis whispered incredulously, listening to fists banging on a neighboring door.
"The Seekers demand right of entry,"
croaked a voice. There was a pause, then the same voice said,
"No one home. Do we kick the door in?"
"Ah,"
said another voice.
"We'd better just report to the Theocrat. Let him kick the door down. Now, if it was unlocked, that'd be different. We're allowed to enter then."
Tanis looked at the door opposite him. He felt the hair rise on the back of his neck. He could have sworn they had shut and bolted the door. Now, it stood slightly open.
"The door,"
he whispered.
"Caramon."
But the warrior had already moved over to stand behind the door, his back to the wall, his giant hands flexing. The footsteps flapped to a stop outside.
"The Seekers demand right of entry."
The goblins began to bang on the door, then stopped in surprise as it swung open.
"This place is empty," said one.
"Let's move on."
"You got no imagination, Grum," said the other. "Here's our chance to pick up a few pieces of silver."
A goblin head appeared around the open door, its eyes focused on Raistlin, sitting calmly, his staff on his shoulder. The goblin grunted in alarm, then began to laugh.
Ho-ho! Look what we've found, a staff!
The goblin's eyes gleamed. It took a step toward Raistlin, its partner crowding close behind.
Hand me that staff.
Certainly,
the mage whispered. He held his own staff forth.
Shirak,
he said. The crystal ball flared into light. The goblins shrieked and shut their eyes, fumbling for their swords. At that moment, Caramon jumped from behind the door, grabbed the goblins around their necks, and swept their heads together with a sickening thud. The goblin bodies crumpled into a stinking heap.
Dead? Asked Tanis, as Caramon bent over them, examining them by the light of Raistlin's staff.
I'm afraid so, the big man sighed. I hit them too hard.
Well, that's torn it,
Tanis said grimly.
We've murdered two more of the Theocrat's guards. He'll have the town up in arms. Now we can't just lie low for a few days. We've got to get out of here. And you two, he turned to the barbarians, had better come with us.
Wherever we're going,
muttered Flint irritably.
Where were you headed?
Tanis asked Riverwind.
We were traveling to Haven,
the barbarian answered reluctantly.
There are wise men there, Goldmoon said. We hoped they could tell us about this staff. You see, the song I sang, it was true. The staff saved our lives.
You'll have to tell us later, Tanis interrupted. When these guards don't report back, every goblin in Solace will be swarming up the trees.
Raistlin, put out that light!
The mage spoke another word.
Dumerk!
The crystal glimmered. Then the light died.
What'll we do with these bodies?
Caramon asked, nudging a dead goblin with his booted foot.
And what about Tika? Won't she get into trouble?
Leave the bodies.
Tanis's mind was working quickly.
And hack up the door. Sturm, knock over a few tables. We'll make it look as if we broke in here and got into a fight with these fellows. That way, Tika shouldn't be in too much trouble.
She's a smart girl. She'll manage.
We'll need food,
Tasselhoff stated. He ran into the kitchen and began rummaging through the shelves, stuffing loaves of bread and everything else that looked edible into his pouches. He tossed Flint a full skin of wine. Sturm overturned a few chairs. Caramon arranged the bodies to make it look as if they had died in a ferocious battle. The plainsmen stood in front of the dying fire, looking at Tanis uncertainly.
Well, said Sturm. Now what? Where are we going?
Tanis hesitated, running over the options in his mind. The plainsmen had come from the east, and if their story was true and their tribe had been trying to kill them, they wouldn't want to go back that way. The group could travel south into the Elven Kingdom, but Tanis felt a strange reluctance to go back to his homelands. He knew, too, that the elves would not be pleased to see these strangers enter their hidden city.
We'll travel north, he said finally. We will escort these two until we come to the crossroads. Then we can decide what to do from there. They can go on southwest to Haven, if they wish. I plan to travel farther north and see if the rumors about armies gathering are true.
And perhaps run into Kitiara.
Raistlin whispered slyly. Tanis flushed. Is that plan all right? He asked, looking around.
Though not the eldest among us, Tanis, you are the wisest, Sturm said. We follow you, as always.
Caramon nodded. Raistlin was already heading for the door. Flint shouldered the wineskin, grumbling. Tanis felt a gentle hand touch his arm. He turned and looked down into the clear blue eyes of the beautiful barbarian.
We are grateful,
Gold Moon said slowly, as if unused to expressing appreciation.
You risk your lives for us, and we are strangers.
Tanis smiled,
and clasped her hand. I am Tanis. The brothers are Caramon and Raistlin. The knight is Sturm Brightblade. Flint Fireforge carries the wine, and Tasselhoff Burfoot is our clever locksmith. You are Gold Moon, and he is Riverwind. There, we are strangers no longer. Gold Moon smiled wearily. She patted Tanis's arm, then started out the door, leaning on the staff that once again seemed plain and nondescript. Tanis watched her, then glanced up to see Riverwind staring at him, the barbarian's dark face an impenetrable mask. Well, Tanis amended silently. Some of us are no longer strangers. Soon, everyone had gone, Tass leading the way. Tanis stood alone for a moment in the wrecked living room, staring at the bodies of the goblins. This was supposed to have been a peaceful homecoming after bitter years of solitary travel. He thought of his comfortable house. He thought of all the things he had planned to do. Things he had planned to do together with Kitiara. He thought of long winter nights, the storytelling around the fire at the inn, then returning home, laughing together beneath the fur blankets, sleeping through the snow-covered mornings. Tanis kicked at the smoldering coals, scattering them. Kitiara had not come back. Goblins had invaded his quiet town. He was fleeing into the night to escape a bunch of religious fanatics, with every likelihood he could never return. Elves do not notice the passage of time. They live for hundreds of years. For them, the seasons pass like brief rain showers. But Tanis was half-human. He sensed change coming, felt the disquieting restlessness men feel before a thunderstorm. He sighed and shook his head. Then he went out the shattered door, leaving it swinging crazily on one hinge.
Chapter 5. Farewell to Flint. Arrows fly. Message in the stars.
Tanis swung over the porch and dropped down through the tree limbs to the ground below. The others waited, huddled in the darkness, keeping out of the light cast by street lamps swinging in the branches above them. A chill wind had sprung up, blowing out of the north. Tanis glanced behind him and saw other lights, lights of the search parties. He pulled his hood over his head and hurried forward.
"Wind switched," he said. "There'll be rain by morning."
He looked around at the small group, seeing them in the eerie, wildly dancing light of the wind-tossed lamps. Gold Moon's face was scarred with weariness. Riverwind's was a stoic mask of strength, but his shoulders sagged. Raistlin, shivering, leaned against a tree, wheezing for breath. Tanis hunched his shoulders against the wind.
"We've got to find shelter," he said. "Some place to rest."
"Tanis!"
Tass tugged on the half-elf's cloak.
"We could go by boat. Crystalmere Lake's only a short way. There are caves on the other side, and it will cut walking time tomorrow."
"That's a good idea, Tass, but we don't have a boat."
"No problem."
The Kender grinned. His small face and sharply pointed ears made him look particularly impish in the eerie light. "Tass is enjoying all of this immensely," Tanis realized. He felt like shaking the Kender, lecturing him sternly on how much danger they were in. But the half-elf knew it was useless. Kender are totally immune to fear.
"The boat's a good idea," Tanis repeated, after a moment's thought. "You guide, and don't tell Flint," he added. "I'll take care of that."
"Right."
Tass giggled, then slipped back to the others.
"Follow me,"
he called out softly, and started off once more. Flint, grumbling into his beard, stumped after the Kender. Gold Moon followed the dwarf. Riverwind cast a quick, penetrating glance around at everyone in the group, then fell into step behind her.
I don't think he trusts us,
Karaman observed. Would you? Tanis asked, glancing at the big man. Karaman's dragon helm glinted in the flickering lights. His ring-mail armor was visible whenever the wind blew his cape back. A longsword clanked against his thick thighs. A short bow and a quiver of arrows were slung over his shoulder. A dagger protruded from his belt. His shield was battered and dented from many fights. The giant was ready for anything. Tanis looked over at Sturm, who proudly wore the coat of arms of a knighthood that had fallen into disgrace 300 years before. Although Sturm was only 4 years older than Karaman, the knight's strict, disciplined life, hardships brought on by poverty, and his melancholy search for his beloved father had aged the knight beyond his years. Only 29. He looked 40. Tanis thought,
I don't think I'd trust us either.
What's the plan? Sturm asked.
We're going by boat,
Tanis answered.
Oh-ho! Karaman chuckled. Told Flint yet?
No. Leave that to me. Where are we getting the boat? Sturm asked suspiciously. You'll be happier not knowing, the half-elf said. The knight frowned. His eyes followed the Kender, who was far ahead of them, flitting from one shadow to another. I don't like this, Tanis. First we're murderers, now we're about to become thieves.
I don't consider myself a murderer, Karaman snorted. Goblins don't count.
Tanis saw the knight glare at Karaman. I don't like any of this, Sturm, he said hastily, hoping to avoid an argument. But it's a matter of necessity. Look at the plainsmen. Pride's the only thing keeping them on their feet. Look at Raistlin. Their eyes went to the mage, who was shuffling through the dry leaves, keeping always in the shadows. He leaned heavily on his staff. Occasionally, a dry cough racked his frail body. Karaman's face darkened.
Tanis is right, he said softly. Raist can't take much more of this. I must go to him.
Leaving the knight and the half-elf, he hurried forward to catch up with the robed, bent figure of his twin.
Let me help you, Raist,
they heard Karaman whisper. Raistlin shook his hooded head and flinched away from his brother's touch. Karaman shrugged and dropped his arm, but the big warrior stayed close to his frail brother, ready to help him if necessary.
Why does he put up with that?
Tanis asked softly.
Family. Ties of blood.
Sturm sounded wistful. He seemed about to say more, then his eyes went to Tanis's elven face with its growth of human hair, and he fell silent. Tanis saw the look, knew what the knight was thinking. Family. Ties of blood. They were things the orphaned half-elf wouldn't know about.
Come on,
Tanis said abruptly. We're dropping behind. They soon left the Valenwood Trees of Solace and entered the pine forest surrounding Crystalmere Lake. Tanis could faintly hear muffled shouts far behind them.
They found the bodies, he guessed.
Sturm nodded gloomily. Suddenly, Tasselhoff seemed to materialize out of the darkness, right beneath the half-elf's nose.
The trail runs a little over a mile to the lake, Tass said. I'll meet you where it comes out.
He gestured, vaguely, then disappeared before Tanis could say a word. The half-elf looked back at Solace. There seemed to be more lights, and they were moving in this direction. The roads were probably already blocked.
Where's the Kender?
Flint grumbled as they plunged through the forest.
Tass is meeting us at the lake,
Tanis replied.
Lake?
Flint's eyes grew wide in alarm.
What lake?
There's only one lake around here, Flint,
Tanis said, trying hard not to smile at Sturm.
Come on, we'd better keep going.
His elven sight showed him the broad red outline of Caramon and the slighter red shape of his brother disappearing into the thick woods ahead.
"I thought we were just going to lie low in the woods for a while."
Flint shoved his way past Sturm to complain to Tanis.
"We're going by boat."
Tanis moved forward.
"Nope,"
Flint growled.
"I'm not going in any boat."
"That accident happened 10 years ago," Tanis said, exasperated. "Look, I'll make Caramon sit still."
"Absolutely not,"
the dwarf said flatly.
"No boats. I took a vow."
"Tanis,"
Sturm's voice whispered behind him.
"Lights!"
"Blast!"
The half-elf stopped and turned. He had to wait a moment before catching sight of lights glittering through the trees. The search had spread beyond Solace. He hurried to catch up with Caramon, Raistlin, and the plainsman.
"Lights!"
he called out in a piercing whisper. Caramon looked back and swore. Riverwind raised his hand in acknowledgement.
"I'm afraid we're going to have to move faster, Caramon,"
Tanis began.
"We'll make it,"
the big man said, unperturbed. He was supporting his brother now, his arm around Raistlin's thin body, practically carrying him. Raistlin coughed softly, but he was moving. Sturm caught up with Tanis. As they forced their way through the brush, they could hear Flint puffing along behind, muttering angrily to himself.
"He won't come, Tanis," Sturm said.
"Flint's been in mortal fear of boats ever since Caramon almost accidentally drowned him that time. You weren't there. You didn't see him after we hauled him out."
"He'll come,"
Tanis said, breathing hard.
"He can't let us youngsters go off into danger without him."
Sturm shook his head, unconvinced. Tanis looked back again. He saw no lights, but he knew they were too deep in the forest now to see them. Thewmaster Turda may not have impressed anybody with his brains, but it wouldn't take much intelligence to figure out that the group might take to the water. Tanis stopped, abruptly, to keep from bumping into someone.
"What is it?"
he whispered.
"We're here,"
Caramon answered. Tanis breathed a sigh of relief as he stared out across the dark expanse of Crystal Mere Lake. The wind whipped the water into frothy whitecaps.
"Where's Tas?"
He kept his voice low.
"There, I think."
Caramon pointed at a dark object floating close to shore. Tanis could barely make out the warm red outline of the Kender sitting in a large boat. The stars gleamed with icy brightness in the blue-black sky. The red moon, Lunitari, was rising like a bloody fingernail from the water. Its partner in the night sky, Solinari, had already risen, marking the lake with molten silver.
"What wonderful targets we're going to make,"
Sturm said irritably. Tanis could see Tasselhoff turning this way and that, searching for them. The half-elf reached down, fumbling for a rock in the darkness. Finding one, he lobbed it into the water. It splashed just a few yards ahead of the boat. Tas, reacting to Tanis' signal, propelled the boat to shore.
"You're going to put all of us in one boat,"
Flint said in horror.
"You're mad, half-elf."
"It's a big boat," Tanis said.
"No, I won't go. If it were one of the legendary white-winged boats of Tarsus, I still wouldn't go. I'd rather take my chances with the Theocrat."
Tanis ignored the fuming dwarf and motioned to Sturm.
"Get everyone loaded up. We'll be along in a moment."
"Don't take too long," Sturm warned.
"Listen."
"I can hear,"
Tanis said grimly.
"Go on."
"What are those sounds?"
Goldmoon asked the knight as he came up to her.
"Goblin search parties," Sturm answered. "Those whistles keep them in contact when they're separated. They're moving into the woods now."
Goldmoon nodded in understanding. She spoke a few words to Riverwind in their own language, apparently continuing a conversation Sturm had interrupted. The big plainsman frowned and gestured back toward the forest with his hand.
"He's trying to convince her to split with us," Sturm realized. "Maybe he's got enough woods lore to hide from goblin search parties for days, but I doubt it."
"Riverwind, Quilando,"
Goldmoon said sharply. Sturm saw Riverwind scowl in anger. Without a word, he turned and stalked toward the boat. Goldmoon sighed and looked after him, deep sorrow in her face.
"Can I do anything to help, lady?"
Sturm asked gently.
"No,"
she replied. Then she said sadly, as if to herself,
"He rules my heart, but I am his ruler. Once, when we were young, we thought we could forget that. But I have been chieftain's daughter too long."
"Why doesn't he trust us?" Sturm asked.
"He has all the prejudices of our people," Gold Moon replied.
"The plainsmen do not trust those who are not human." She glanced back.
"Tanis cannot hide his elven blood beneath a beard.
Then there are the dwarf, the Kender."
"And what of you, lady?"
Sturm asked. "Why do you trust us? Don't you have these same prejudices?" Gold Moon turned to face him.
He could see her eyes, dark and shimmering as the lake behind her.
"When I was a girl," she said in her deep, low voice, "I was a princess of my people. I was a priestess. They worshipped me as a goddess. I believed in it. I adored it. Then something happened."
She fell silent, her eyes filled with memories.
"What was that?"
Sturm prompted softly.
"I fell in love with a shepherd."
Gold Moon answered, looking at Riverwind. She sighed and walked toward the boat. Sturm watched Riverwind wade into the water to drag the boat closer to shore as Raistlin and Caraman reached the water's edge. Raistlin clutched his robes around him, shivering.
"I can't get my feet wet,"
he whispered hoarsely. Caraman did not reply. He simply put his huge arms around his brother, lifted him as easily as he would have lifted a child, and set Raistlin in the boat. The mage huddled in the aft part of the boat, not saying a word of thanks.
"I'll hold her steady," Caraman told Riverwind. "You get in."
Riverwind hesitated a moment, then climbed quickly over the side. Caraman helped Gold Moon into the boat. Riverwind caught hold of her and steadied her as the boat rocked gently. The plainsmen moved to sit in the stern, behind Tasselhoff. Caraman turned to Sturm as the night drew near.
"What's happening back there?"
"Flint says he'll burn before he'll get in a boat. At least then he'll die warm instead of wet and cold."
"I'll go up and haul him down here,"
Caraman said.
"You'd only make things worse. You were the one that nearly drowned him, remember? Let Tanis handle it. He's the diplomat."
Caraman nodded. Both men stood, waiting, in silence. Sturm saw Gold Moon look at Riverwind in mute appeal, but the plainsman did not heed her glance. Tasselhoff, fidgeting on his seat, started to call out a shrill question, but a stern look from the knight silenced him. Raistlin huddled in his robes, trying to suppress an uncontrollable cough.
"I'm going up there,"
Sturm said finally. "Those whistles are getting closer. We don't dare take any more time."
But at that moment he saw Tanis shake hands with the dwarf and begin to run toward the boat, alone. Flint stayed where he was near the edge of the woods. Sturm shook his head.
"I told Tanis the dwarf wouldn't come."
"Stubborn as a dwarf, so the old saying goes," Caraman grunted. "And that one's had 148 years to grow stubborner."
The big man shook his head sadly.
"Well, we'll miss him,
That's for certain. He's saved my life more than once.
Let me go get him.
One punch on the jaw and he won't know whether he's in a boat or his own bed.
Tanis ran up, panting, and heard the last comment.
No, Caraman, he said.
Flint would never forgive us.
Don't worry about him.
He's going back to the hills. Get in the boat.
There are more lights coming this way.
We left a trail through the forest a blind gully dwarf could follow.
No sense all of us getting wet,
Caraman said, holding the side of the boat.
You and Sturm get in. I'll shove off.
Sturm was already over the side. Tanis patted Caraman on the back, then climbed in. The warrior pushed the boat out into the lake. He was up to his knees in water when they heard a call from the shore.
Hold it!
It was Flint, running down from the trees, a vague, moving shape of blackness against the moonlit shoreline.
Hang on, I'm coming!
Stop!
Tanis cried. Caraman, wait for Flint!
Look!
Sturm half rose, pointing. Lights had appeared in the trees, smoking torches held by goblin guards.
Goblins, Flint!
Tanis yelled.
Behind you! Run!
The dwarf, never questioning, put his head down and pumped for the shore, one hand on his helm to keep it from flying off.
I'll cover him,
Tanis said, unslinging his bow. With his elven sight, he was the only one who could see the goblins behind the torches. Fitting an arrow to his bow, Tanis stood as Caraman held the big boat steady. Tanis fired at the outline of the lead goblin.